When it comes to weight loss, no two people are the same. That's why Noom builds personalized plans based on your unique psychology and biology. Take Brittany. After years of unsustainable diets, Noom helped her lose 20 pounds and keep it off.
I was definitely in a yo-yo cycle for years of just losing weight, gaining weight, and it was exhausting.
And Stephanie. She's a former D1 athlete who knew she couldn't out-train her diet, and she lost 38 pounds.
My relationship to food before Noom was never consistent.
And Evan, he can't stand salads, but he still lost 50 pounds with Noom.
I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. Even through the pickiness, Noom taught me that building better habits builds a healthier lifestyle. I'm not doing this to get to a number. I'm doing this to feel better.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom users compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hey, everybody. Tonight we're debating whether or not there is evidence for evolution, and we are starting right now with Dr. Wilson's opening statement. Thanks so much for being with us, Dr. Wilson. The floor is all yours.
Hey, James. Thanks for having me. I'm real excited to be here. So, I go by Dr. Wilson on YouTube. I have a PhD in molecular biology, so that's what I'm going to be focusing on in the context of evolution. So, to get started here, I'm just going to share my screen. And my expertise is in the world of molecular biology. So that means I work with proteins, DNA, and RNA, and all of these things fall under the same principles of evolution as whole organisms. And I want to start on the molecular level by going over just one biomolecule that's really near and dear to my heart. And that would be I need to do the slideshow. That would help. That would be the ribosome. So in graduate school, I worked on the ribosome, specifically on how the cell builds its ribosome. And I've specifically heard Nephilim Free mentioned before that the ribosome is what makes ATP in the cell. And I just had to be honest, that hurt me a little bit because that is not the role of the ribosome. ATP is generally made in the mitochondria, which is, as chat will know, the powerhouse of the cell. Yes, hooray, cool. But the point that Nephilim usually makes when he brings up a giant macromolecule like the ribosome is that it's irreducibly complex. The idea being that it's so complex that you cannot reduce it to a simpler model. Therefore, it could not have evolved. But that's not really true. In fact, when we examine the ribosomes that exist in today's organisms, ranging from more evolutionarily ancient, for example, bacteria, to more evolutionary recent, so for example, humans, we do see that the ribosome has a general decrease in complexity as you go more further back in the evolutionary timeline. This demonstrates two principles when we look at ribosomes in this context. One is that you don't have to have a macromolecule like the ribosome as complex as we see it in humans. It can exist in simpler forms. The other principle that we learn is that there are very many core elements of the ribosome that are conserved from bacteria to humans. So these elements are the same despite hundreds of millions of years of evolution. This tells us that this is evidence that life is linked over a long, long time scale. So not only is, and these principles apply not only to the ribosome, but to lots of different complicated molecular structures in the molecular world. So, what are some other examples, right, of things being similar across very large evolutionary time spans from multiple different organisms? Well, another example of this are Hox genes. So Hox genes are genes that exist in most organisms that have a segmented body plan. So organisms like the fruit fly, organisms like you and me, humans, and these genes simply work in a way that plans out the body of the organism, such that if we were to mutate some of them, a fly might grow legs on its head, where instead of growing legs at a different segment in its body. That's how these genes work. But the really interesting thing is that when we compare these Hox genes from more ancient organisms like the fruit fly to humans, we see that there are a lot of paralogs between humans and Drosophila. And these paralogs are ordered in the exact same order, and they're on generally one chromosome. Each set is on one chromosome, and they're ordered in the exact same way. So we have this parallel between fruit flies, for example, and humans that spans hundreds of millions of years of evolution. And this is very strong evidence of evolution, because the model is that these genome structure changed over time, picked up new functions, added new information and new mutations, which ultimately gave rise to the rich variety of species that we see today. Another good piece of evidence of evolution when it comes to the genome comparing across species is that between humans and our closely related cousins, chimps, gorilla, and orangutans. And this comes in the form of the fact that chimps, gorillas, and orangutans have one extra set of chromosomes than relative to humans. So in chimps, gorillas, and orangutans, there will be two chromosomes, two, for example, a chromosome 2A, a chromosome 2B. But in humans, we just have a chromosome 2. And what happened at some point in our common ancestors' history is that these two chromosomes fused. So these genetic fusion events can be characterized and observed to have occurred. And when we look at the rest of the chromosome, we can see that the same genes are located on the same portions of the chromosome. So this either tells us that a creator created things this way, or that this is exactly consistent with evolution. Another great point that always comes to my mind when I think of molecular evolution is, well, how do we know that these molecular changes were really passed down from flies, for example, to humans? Well, we can see in the example of embryogenesis, the development of fetuses, of things like lizards and mammals, that the information for these ancient structures, such as gills, a tail, and so forth, are still contained in our genome as these structures are made and then ultimately turned off as we develop in utero. So this information is in our genomes because we are descended from a long line of common ancestors. And last, what I'll cover for my opening statement is just, I know that Nephilim, for example, likes to bring up this point that genomes can't produce new information. And that's just not true. There are several mechanisms by which a genome can essentially evolve new information. And this paper here is one such example. In it, the authors were working with bacteria, and they identified this mechanism that they call innovation, amplification, and divergence. You can read the highlighted sections on screen, but I'll just summarize by saying that essentially what they did was they took a gene that encodes an enzyme and studied it in the context of a bacteria. They then introduced selection pressures to that environment, to the environment of that bacteria. And they were able to cause this enzyme to adopt a new function that helped it better survive in that environment. This is, again, just one such example that was characterized here. And what the mechanism also explains is that the cell accomplishes this by first duplicating that gene. So the common thing that some creationists might say is that mutations are usually deleterious, they're usually harmful, but cells can circumvent that problem if they first are able to duplicate their gene, and then it is that duplicated gene is free to evolve with little consequences because the original version remains functional for the cell. So the authors were able to achieve this evolution within 3,000 generations. They confirmed it with sequencing, and they were able to, they also describe in the paper some other mechanisms aside from this innovation, amplification, and divergence that exists in humans as well. So that's kind of a rundown of what comes to my mind when I think of evidence for evolution in the molecular world. I think that the main crux of this conversation for me is going to be, you can examine all of these changes, all these similarities between genomes across organisms that are separated by hundreds of millions of years of evolution. And you can say that a creator created it that way. You can say that it's evidence for evolution. But the difference between the two statements is that only one of those ideas are testable or falsifiable. So for example, if we go back in the evolutionary timeline and along the way we find a new ape species that is much more closely related to a lizard than any other known ape, that would be a real problem for evolution to explain. But if
20 seconds.
Right. But if a creationist saw that evidence, they could still say that a creator created it that way. So it's not falsifiable, it's not testable, and it's not really science, whereas evolution is testable and observable. And I'll stop there.
You got to thank you very much, Dr. Wilson, for that opening statement. And want to let you know, folks, if it's your first time here at Modern Day Debate, we are a neutral platform hosting debates on science, religion, and politics. And folks, if you haven't heard, one sec, Neff, if you want to wait for a moment before.
Oh, I'm sorry. I thought you had to approve it. Okay, sorry.
But want to let you know, folks, we're absolutely thrilled for this monster event that is coming tomorrow night. You don't want to miss it. Matt Dillahunty and Christian apologist and scholar Dr. Kenny Rhodes will be here debating whether or not there is good evidence for God. You don't want to miss it, folks. So if you haven't yet, hit that subscribe button and that notification bell so you don't miss it. And with that, we'll kick it over to Nephilim Free for his opening as well. Thanks, Nephilim Free. The floor is all yours.
Thank you. So on a share screen, something, is it sharing?
Yep.
Okay. All right. So evolution, first off, you have to understand that evolution is an ancient myth. It was begun by the Hindu Brahmin, passed on from them to the ancient Egyptians and Babylonians, who passed it on to the ancient Greeks, Thales of Miletus, Anaximander, Anaximenes, and Aristotle spoke of evolution. They had a different idea. They believed that creatures were originally created, but those created kinds evolved, very much like what evolutionists say today, with the exception of what Charles Darwin's claim, anti-scientific claim was. Charles Darwin unified the idea that the created kinds, created by the gods, were actually came from a single ancestor. So he codified the modern theory of evolution by coming up with the idea that all the created kinds actually had a common ancestor, and there were no created kinds. But prior to that, so evolution is actually an ancient religious myth. It's a religious myth. It is very ancient. It goes back to the earliest history of mankind, almost. The only evidence that we have for evolution is what somebody sees when they believe evolution. Evolutionists are required to ignore a mountain of scientific evidence, and they do so pragmatically and dogmatically, militaristically. My opponent says, firstly, let me say that he spoke about ribosomes. I did misspeak, is what I said, about ribosomes and ATP. I meant to say ATP synthase. That was simply a misspeak. If my opponent had watched quite a number of my videos, he would have heard me speak about ATP synthase producing ATP, not ribosomes. That was just a misspeak. He spoke about, we have evidence that ribosomes going back into the distant past demonstrate evolutionary transition from one type of creature to another. That's bogus. We don't have any ancient ribosomes preserved in the fossil record that we can observe. What we have is various types of ribosomes that exist in creatures today, and evolutionists make grand assumptions that, well, ribosomes that are different today means they've always changed. See, the change is the assumption. He said, mentioned chromosome 2. Chromosome 2 has been discredited as an evolutionary fusion event. Genes that span the fusion site code for polymerase and genes that cause specialization of cells that are relate to almost 200 different types of cells in the human body. So the evolutionist would be required to believe, if chromosome 2 were actual fusion site, that evolution has somehow written over a telomere information that's critical, and it produces molecular machinery necessary for the organism to exist, such as helicase and polymerase, because both span the chromosome 2 site. Span it. That means they pass over it. Now, that simply can't be. It's irrational to believe that random mutations wrote the genes that produce helicase and polymerase over a telomere. That just doesn't make any sense. It's not sensical. No geneticist would say that's logical. Okay, so he mentions genetic Hox gene similarity. There are tremendous dissimilarities in Hox genes. Maybe my opponent's not aware of the fact that the Hox genes that produce the lobe fins in fish, which allegedly evolved into the legs of lizards or amphibians, are not the same genes. But evolution would have us believe that mutations modified those Hox genes, so that instead of producing lobe fins in fish, now they produce legs. You see, because that's the evolution story. The genes that produced legs produced wings as evolution produced birds, right? See, the same genes preserved, modified by numerous mutations, now they produce wings instead of legs, right? The same is true for the lobe fin fishes. The lobe fin fishes, Hox genes allegedly received mutations that transformed them into legs so that the fish walked out on land. But this doesn't work. Why? Because the genes are not the same Hox genes. The Hox genes in a fish that are not the same set of genes in the same location in the genome as the genes, Hox genes, in a reptile or an amphibian that produced legs. And the same is true of birds. The Hox genes in reptiles, evolutionists claim reptiles evolved into birds, that in reptiles are not the same Hox genes in the same location of the genome as those that produced the wings of birds. Now, the evolutionists can argue against this by saying, oh, well, they'll try to fix the problem. Well, mutation moved the Hox genes. Uh-oh, problem. Medical science has documented in the journals hundreds of times that when you translocate a set of genes, You've produced deformities that are so severe, the creature is usually stillborn or dies shortly after birth, or has a terrible deformity or chromosomal disorder that haunts them their entire life. Natural selection would remove such an organism, not promote it. Therefore, that idea doesn't fit evolution. That's bad science. It doesn't work. Now, new information. The evolutionist has this fake belief that mutations happen that duplicate genetic information. And then my opponent says that mutation, then the duplicated gene is free to be mutated and become new information that comes. See, this is where this is called hand waving. This is where they pass it off. This is where they slide it under the table. It's a card trick. Okay. They'll talk about, well, how do you get the new information? Well, a gene can be duplicated. Rare event. Very rare. Okay. According to geneticists, that's very rare. And then they'll say it's free to become mutated, to become new information. That's never been observed. That's what's never been observed. Hand sliding. See, look, mutations can happen to duplicate a gene. Therefore, new information, because new mutations have changed that information. That's what's not been observed. They want you to believe that because they can point to the fact that a rare mutation can duplicate a gene in the genome, and it is rare, it's not common, it's very rare, that means, oh, well, I must believe then that subsequent mutations are going to transform that duplicated gene into information that's new and functional and produces new anatomical features. No. We don't need that assumption. That's your assumption. That's not science. That's what you believe, maybe. That's not science. Okay? You can't demonstrate that. Nobody's ever demonstrated it. Okay, so evolution is observable and testable was the last statement my opponent made. Nobody says so. Even Richard Dawkins agrees. He says evolution is not observable. It's just we observe it in the past. That's what he says. We observe it by looking at the past with our rose-colored glasses and assume it. Now, evolution is scientifically impossible. 90 years of study into the effects of random genetic mutation have been conducted since the 1930s, since the days of Haldane. And guess what? 90 years, over 1 million studies. If you printed them all with a desktop printer and stacked the papers, they'd be multiple stories tall. That's how many papers have been published in the science journals about the observed effects of random genetic mutation in science since the 1930s. Multiple stories worth of papers. 90 years worth. And guess what? Nobody has ever demonstrated that it's been observed. The mutations build anything that's structural and functional in any organism. Ever. Never. Not once. Nothing. What mutations have been proven to do in science for 90 years is cause weaknesses, deformities, and stillbirth, or death prior to birth, but never new biological structures. The evolutionist believes in their mythology passed down from the Hindu Brahmin to the ancient Greeks, spoken to us by Thales of Miletus, Anaximander, Anaximenes, and Aristotle, that the mutation, the modern version of this, is the mutations create the structural designs of living things. If evolution were true, all the anatomical features of every single creature in this world, the proboscis of a mosquito, the nasal passages of a mouse, the brain of a human being, in every anatomical, the kidney of a chimpanzee, every anatomical feature in every creature in this world would have been, had to have been produced by random mutations accruing on genes, to cause them to build in information that produced new structural designs in the anatomy of living things. If that were not true, evolution cannot be true, because everything would have the same anatomy. Anatomical change is necessary for evolution to occur. There's zero scientific evidence that genetic mutations have the potential to cause anatomical change that's functional and becomes fixed. Now, don't straw man me. Functional and becomes fixed in a population. Mutations can cause anatomical deformities, which natural selection removes, but it never has been observed, and we have no scientific reason to believe the mutations cause new structural design that's functional, useful, and preserved in populations because of mutation. Never observed. No scientist has reported that in any science paper in 90 years, ever. What modern science, not the ancient myth of evolution, passed on to the Greeks from the Hindu Brahmin and the Egyptians and the Babylonians, has demonstrated is that life is so complex down to the molecular level that it's implausible to believe that evolution is true. It's obvious a mind was involved. In fact, DNA has been proven to be a physical model molecule that could never arise by sheer natural chemistry. It can't produce the nucleotides, all of them, that will even produce it, or the sugar ribose backbone molecule. It's not going to happen. Natural chemistry cannot produce the DNA molecule. But upon that, we have this. DNA is a physical medium, just like a book is a printed medium, encoded with digital, overlapping, nested, hierarchical, highly complex information, which operates linguistically with phonetics, semantics, punctuation, syntax, grammar, semiotics, and acrobatics, and operates algorithmically. The problem for the evolutionists here is that information, semiotics, and algorithms arise only from an intelligence. Therefore, it's an empirical scientific fact. Because DNA, I'm done. Thank you.
We will kick it into open conversation and want to let you know, folks, our guests are linked in the description. So if you want to hear more from our guests, you certainly can by clicking on those links in the description box. And that includes if you're listening via podcast. As folks, we are pumped that Modern Day Debate does have a podcast, and you can find our guests' links in the description box for each podcast episode as well. So with that, we'll kick into open dialogue. Thanks so much, gentlemen. The floor is all yours.
Okay. Thanks, Nephilim. Not quite sure where to start here, but I guess a good place to start would be, it's kind of weird that you're saying that no beneficial mutations have ever been recorded. Is that fair to say that that's what you said? Hello?
Nephilim Free, are you on mute?
No, I'm sorry. I'm here.
Yeah, so is that, did I hear that right? Is that you're saying that no beneficial mutations have been recorded?
That's straw man. I said, nobody has observed that random mutations, occurring mutations in a population, build anatomical features that are functional and useful and preserved by natural selection.
But I thought I also heard you say that mutations have only been recorded to be deleterious, like cause deformities and stillbirths.
I didn't say that. But beneficial mutations are outrageously rare. Possibly one out of every 2 million mutations, according to geneticists in the late 1990s.
Well, the reason for that is that mutation is always happening, and you're not necessarily going to notice the beneficial ones unless there's a specific selection pressure.
Well, if they're that rare, how in the world are they going to build anatomical structures over a trillion years?
Well, with a very long time. They're happening all the time. And so when
can you give us examples of that?
To respond, Nephilim Free.
So they're happening all the time, even randomly generated nucleic acid sequences can yield functional properties that can offer advantages depending on the natural selections you place on the organism. For example, we have this paper here where the scientists measured just that. They had a set of random non-coding DNA. So this DNA was not coding. And they basically cloned all of these random DNA sequences into just an E. coli bacteria and then did competitive growth experiments and found, contrary to their expectations, that about 25% of the randomly generated cloned DNA actually enhanced their growth rate. So these are randomly generated non-functional segments of DNA that end up developing or evolving a function when correct selection pressures are placed upon them.
So, well, you say function. I don't see a function. Nobody described a function. Secondly, you pointed something that causes cancer, an increased growth rate over the normal growth rate. That's exactly what cancer is, you know.
Well, let me
respond. So that's not, you haven't provided any evidence for evolution. All you've pointed out is that mutations can cause an increase in growth rate, which is above normal. And that's a bad thing for an organism. Yeah. So what you've done is what evolutionists always do. You've seen something that causes change, and you've read into that millions of ideas of evolution, but science doesn't demonstrate that. See, evolution isn't science. It's the ideas in your head.
Can I ask you a question? Can E. coli get cancer?
Well, no, but you're talking about that's a straw man. You're talking about a single organism.
because you're saying that this
that's
isn't
a straw man.
Well, no, you're saying yes. No, you're yes. Saying that. Let me finish.
The article is about multicellular organisms, is it not?
No, this article is working with bacteria.
Okay, so growth rate does that relate to reproduction?
Fitness. It relates to fitness.
How does growth rate relate to fitness?
Because these are competitive assays. The organisms
that
out-compete.
How does that produce?
You have to let them finish when you ask the question.
Yeah.
The organisms that outcompete the rest of the E. coli are the most fit. So it relates to their fitness.
Are you familiar with Lansky's experiment, which has fizzled down to a drizzling draw and to a death, where Lansky's experiment has in the last couple of years demonstrated that the population is completely unsustainable, and now the mutations have actually virtually destroyed everything, and they're all dying because they become so dependent upon the specific environment provided by the researchers, that if released into the lab, into the natural environment, they would simply die almost immediately. So what you're calling specialization really is specialization to survive. You're not providing evidence that science, that genetics causes any new structural designs to arise in body plans, which would be necessary for evolution. An organism becoming specialized in its ability to survive in a restricted environment is an adaptation, which is an example of intelligent design, but doesn't demonstrate any evolutionary mechanism. Evolutionists love to pretend that evolution doesn't say what evolution does. And what evolution says is structural designs change over time to give us every proboscis, every feature, every eyeball of every creature that lives in this earth. But they can't ever talk about that. Instead, what they talk about is a bacteria can survive in an environment highly selective, highly managed by the laboratory experimenters, and then if released into the environment, because they've become so specialized to that environment, they would die. And that's not evolution in the real world. That's selective pressure in a petri dish. That's not evidence of evolution.
Well, I will say that by definition, an organism becoming especially accustomed or fit to a lab environment is still evolution, because evolution will naturally try to push an organism towards its optimal fitness in a particular environment. Not optimal, just an acceptable fitness.
All right, so let's try to merge, take your idea and extrapolate it to the real world. So the organism becomes specialized in a highly controlled environment produced by a researcher, which fed a specific food at a specific temperature, a specific amount of light, et cetera, for a very long period of time. And it adapts to survive in that environment. Now, what evidence is there from that, that anatomical features, that biology, the mutations, design changes to structural designs, create body plan changes, morphological change, that leads us to believe that a creature with a fundamentally different design can arise from one with a fundamentally different design? Because if evolution were true, that's what you got to have evidence for. Creatures becoming specialized in a petri dish doesn't help evolution. What's the evidence for real evolution?
Yeah. So I know what you're asking, but the point here is that these experiments in the molecular world that identify fundamental mechanisms by which a genome can grow, change, develop new genes, so on and so forth, all of those things still apply to the macro world. And we can observe evidence of these events happening in the genomes that we see today. For example, in the form of pseudogenes, genes that were once functional but now are not. And also another example being what I brought up in the opening statement with the HOX genes, which I think the point there was that the order in which HOX genes are organized on a particular chromosome is conserved throughout millions of years of evolution. That was the main point. They don't all have to be the same. There are plenty of paralogs between organisms, but the point is that the order in which they're organized is conserved. And that is a very striking similarity that is kind of what we would exactly expect if one were to predict evolution and go looking for evidence of it in the genome.
Well, I didn't hear any evidence for what I asked for. I heard assumptions. And when it comes to pseudogenes, I'm not going to read all this to you. This is just a fraction of the information I have available to me. I don't know if you're aware of it, but pseudogenes, what are called pseudogenes, many, many, many of them have been discovered to actually have function. They're not pseudo at all. In fact, they actually have function.
So
here's the thing. If evolution is true, mutation and natural selection has to create all the anatomical features of every living thing in this world. We have no scientific evidence that's true. What we have is a petri dish. You can give a selective food source under a right temperature to a bacteria, and it'll survive. Lenski's experiments have just about fizzled now. The bacteria are so specialized, and there's so many broken genes, they're almost dead. Are you aware of this? Lenski has reported it himself. Okay, you're aware of Lenski's experiment going on for what, 35, 40 years right now? Right. And how and other scientists produced the very same kind of experiment. One produced, I can't remember his name, from the 30s till the 1970s or something, a similar experiment. He produced the very same thing. The bacteria specialized, and when released into the environment, die because they can't survive anymore. I'm not hearing evidence that evolution by natural selection and mutation produces the physical features that explain the variance, the variety. If there's a Darwinian tree of life or even a bush or a web, okay, you have to believe that mutations and natural selection builds the structures that build all the creatures, the incredible variety of things in this world. That's what we can never get evolutionists to give us evidence for. Instead, they argue for ridiculous things like bacteria can continue to survive in a petri dish.
So I'm not sure why you think that a bacteria becoming hyper adapted to a lab environment is not evidence of evolution.
Explained it to you, didn't I? Because it doesn't change the anatomy of the bacteria one tiny bit. It doesn't give us any more evidence of evolution than any of the mutations observed in any of the other organisms, including deer and human beings, that have been observed, tested, and repeated in a laboratory or measured reported in the journals. What we observe the effects of mutation, and this is where evolutionists jump science. They skip science. They hate science. You actually hate science. You hate the fact that science has reported for 90 years.
Okay, so
mutations cause weakness, deformity, and death. And you believe this mythological thing that mutations don't do that. Instead, they build fantastically complex, interdependent, functional, new stuff. That's what you need evidence for. If you can't provide that, you have zero evidence of evolution.
Yeah, that's I'm telling you the fundamental mechanisms of DNA that give rise to all of those differences. But let me say first that you can change the morphology of bacteria in the lab with experiments that
can I,
are
can
evolutionarily
I ask you a question,
driven.
Sir?
For example,
anatomy or morphology?
We did just let you speak, so let's let him finish. What are you saying?
You can change anatomy and morphology, it's kind of the same thing with a bacteria, but when it comes to biofilm, so bacteria will come together in these communities to form what we call biofilms. Those have a very specific morphology, anatomy, whatever you like to call it. They have very specific structures to them. And you can observe evolution of biofilms in the lab. So, I mean, that's kind of an example of that in the molecular micro world. But if we take that to the macro world, all of these principles of new information arising in the genome, all these mechanisms, they still apply to organisms like you and me. And we can see the changes just in the past recent history that these kinds of changes can cause in the genome just with speciation in plants, for example, or how far we've taken wolves out of their environment and evolved them into all the different forms of dog that we see. I know that you're probably going to say it's still the same kind, but those genetic mechanisms are causing all of those drastic morphological differences that we can observe. So it's observable.
Okay, so you're confusing, as evolutionists always do, morphology with anatomy. I hear this all the time. It's a favorite tactic of theirs. What anatomical change has ever been observed in one of the things I would like you to address is because you said they're kind of the same thing with comes
in
to
bacteria.
Okay. So what anatomical, what I would like you to address is what anatomical feature has been observed to arise in bacteria by mutation and natural selection? I'm going to tell you right up front, the answer is none.
Biofilms.
None, no. And morphology is form and structure. Anatomy is the structural design of a functional feature which has critical interdependence with the rest of the body plan. That's an anatomical thing. Nobody's ever observed an anatomical feature arise incrementally in any bacteria, ever. What we observed is morphological. The bacteria can change shape. They can be completely round or they can be elongated. You know,
so
they can
be
oblong. But when nobody has ever observed this, see, you're confusing morphology and anatomy because evolutionists love to do this. They love to play this game that, look, morphology can change, therefore anatomy changes. No. Stop right there. No.
Can you just for a second give me an example of what an anatomical change in a bacteria would be?
I hear that question every time I bring this up from every evolutionist. They always ask that. So because you believe that morphological changes over time equate to anatomical change, but you can't provide the science of that.
What's the evidence
of it?
But if you could just answer my question, what's an example?
I would ask you to give us the evidence. You said they're kind of the same thing. Can you tell us the evidence that they're the same thing?
No, I didn't say they're the same thing.
You said they're kind of the same thing.
Let him finish.
That's a quote.
You said, quote, they're kind of the same thing when it comes to bacteria, end quote.
Let me
talk for a sec. Please don't misrepresent what I say. Please hold on a second. When it comes to bacteria, anatomy and morphology, okay, bacteria don't have a body plan. So if you're talking about anatomy, it's technically doesn't apply to bacteria. Morphology is the correct term, but we're talking colloquially here. So I just said they're kind of the same thing when it comes to bacteria. When it comes to organisms like you and I, it's not the same thing. I'm perfectly aware of that, but I'm talking about new genetic information causing morphological changes in bacteria.
Right, back to morphology. See, when I caught you in this, hand game, you know, slipping the nuts around and looking for the pea underneath them, you revert back to morphology. See, that's the game evolutionists always play. The arrival of a flagellum would be a new anatomical feature in a bacteria. Would you not agree?
Great.
Just say yes or no, and then let me finish my response, please.
Would that be anatomical
in a bacteria or not?
Technically,
or morphological.
Technically, not. No, because bacteria don't have a body.
It wouldn't be anatomical. Okay, so you're saying that if a bacteria had no flagellum and then it had one, that would not be anatomical.
It does not have a body plan, so I don't believe that.
You have to give him more than two words to respond to these questions. Do you get that?
I think we're kind of spiraling into semantics here, and that's not really helping the conversation here, because the core issue that I'm trying to get across here is that there are mechanistic changes in DNA that we can observe, we can test, that result in changes in fitness, and in the case of bacteria, direct morphological structural changes. And we can observe the same thing when we apply those mechanisms, take what we learn in bacteria and apply it to organisms like you and I, look at the genomes of dogs, plants, any organism you choose, and you can find evidence of these exact mechanisms having taken place over long periods of time.
So are you saying that bacteria have no anatomy? There are not anatomical features to a bacteria. Like a flagellum is not an anatomical feature in a bacteria. Or a ribosome is not an anatomical feature. Or the cell membrane is not an anatomical feature. Or the proteins which span through the membrane of the bacteria that either allow or disallow other elements to enter into vacuoles. Those are not anatomical features. Are you actually telling me that bacteria have no anatomy? There are no structural designs that are functional, that are part of the bacterial cell? Are you seriously doing that?
So like I said, I think we're getting into semantics here. I don't believe that
I
anatomy.
Asked you a question.
I don't believe that anatomy is the correct word, because cells don't have a body plan.
They don't.
When we talk about cells, we usually talk about their physiology, their structure.
So if a cell has
anatomy.
If a cell, I don't care how you use it. Evolutionists use it. If a cell has a flagellum or has no flagellum, another bacteria has none, is that not anatomical? Would not anatomy be considered a structural design which is biomechanically functional? Is that not correct? Would you not consider an anatomical feature to be one that is a biomechanical feature?
Again,
if that's correct, then would not the existence of a flagellum or the absence of one be considered an anatomical difference between two species of bacteria? And then what is your scientific evidence that random genetic mutations have the ability to create anatomical features in complex organisms?
Again, I don't think that anatomy is the correct word when talking about cells.
You didn't answer my question. I asked you if the existence or the non-existence of a flagellum would be an anatomical difference in a bacteria.
And I'm telling you, I don't think anatomy is the right word. But let's just get back to the core
issue. That would be morphological then?
Let's get back to the core issue here.
But can I ask you, would that be morphological and not anatomical in your mind?
I would call it a change in cell structure.
But you wouldn't call it morphological, but you did say that morphology and anatomy are basically the same thing when it comes to bacteria. We all heard you say that a few minutes ago.
I don't hear the word anatomy used.
But that's what you said.
because you brought up the word anatomy.
No, you said that bacterial, when it comes to bacteria, anatomy and morphology are basically the same thing. So okay, no, is that not an anatomical difference if a bacteria has no flagellum and another has? Because there are plenty of species that don't, plenty that do.
This is getting way off track, but
I want to answer for your beliefs.
I've answered several times. Right, but let's get back to something you said earlier. Were you asserting, in your definition of anatomy for a cell, let's just take that and go with it. Were you talking about structure of a cell membrane as being anatomical?
No, I didn't mention membranes.
You did.
Later I did, but I wasn't. I said that the when it comes to bacteria, we're talking about a simple organism, and there's no such thing as a simple.
Would you consider a change? Would in your definitions of what we're talking about here, would you consider a change to the cell membrane as an anatomical change?
I said, wait, didn't I describe anatomical as biological, functional?
Yeah, you included cell membrane when you talked about that. I wrote it down.
Physical thing, right? So I think a protein spanning through the membrane, if it exists, that has a feature where it creates a port, for example, in the membrane of a bacteria, I would consider that anatomical. If you don't, then I don't know. It seems like you're the one playing games with anatomy and morphology because you don't want to support evolution. I'm asking for evidence of evolution. You're telling me that there's no anatomical difference between bacteria, but then we have plenty of bacteria that have flagellum and some that don't. So is that anatomical or morphological?
Again, you're getting deep into
question. Is it anatomical or morphological?
I'm dead serious. I'm going to start muting you liberally if you keep giving him two words to respond with. He gets more than two words. That's fair, right?
Listen, you brought up anatomy. We are now in this really deep and I think unproductive conversation, a semantic conversation about anatomy and morphology. I told you that I don't think that anatomy is the word that cell biologists use when describing cellular structures. But you want to have this dichotomy between morphology and anatomy, which I get is important when talking about organisms with a body plan. But I'm not trying to talk about that right now. I'm trying to ask you, if a cell were to drastically change its cell membrane, would you consider that an anatomical change in your definition? We can call it morphological, structural, whatever you like, but is that kind of along the lines of what you want to see when it comes to these structural changes in the cellular world?
So you're asking me the same question that you refuse to answer. I don't have to answer it. Because you refuse to tell me whether or not the presence or absence of a flagellum in a bacteria would be anatomical or morphological after telling us 15 minutes ago that morphology and anatomy are kind of the same thing when it comes to bacteria, end quote.
Okay, so I don't think
good
we're
job
getting
with that. So okay. It's obvious that you're playing games with words because you won't answer my questions, and you can't answer my questions with science that demonstrates evolution. Now, I can skip the bacteria altogether and go on to what are considered complex organisms, or rather, i.e., multicellular organisms with intercellular systems like organs, right? And ask you the same question, and you'll play the same game. You won't be able to do it. What's the scientific evidence that in random mutations acted upon by natural selection are able to build in the anatomy structural, functional, biological features so that we can believe there's a tree or a web or brush of life, that all organisms have a common ancestry? And you won't be able to answer that question either. We could spend 18 hours in this live chat and you won't be able to do it. So what is the evidence for evolution? The mutations building upon each other when 90 years of mutation experimentation have been performed and nobody's ever reported any such thing. You believe it, I know. What's the scientific evidence that that occurs? Okay.
We're going to Dr. Wilson a chance to respond, and then I think it's a good idea if we explore other, you could say, sub-arguments in this topic. And so, Dr. Wilson, go ahead, and then maybe we'll change gears to a new topic before we go into the Q&A in maybe about 25 minutes or so.
Okay, yeah. So I don't think we're getting anywhere on this topic, but where I was trying to get to was if you're looking for an anatomical change in the cellular molecular world, the easiest thing to point to would be sickle cell anemia, which is a complete structural change of a red blood cell from a biconcave disc to a crescent shape. And that all happens from one point mutation in one protein. And so in the molecular world, that's a pretty drastic change. But obviously when it gets to bigger organisms, those changes are not going to be as drastic with just one point mutations, you know, from results that we can see physically, such as a different sized appendage or a new body part. Those changes are going to happen much more slowly over time. So that's why we don't directly observe these things happening in our lifetimes or in the last hundreds or thousands of years that we've been recording history, because evolution predicts that those drastic changes are going to take a very long time in order to accumulate enough mutations to affect a body part that drastically. So, but in the molecular world, we can see it pretty easily, and we know the mechanisms that cause that, and we know those mechanisms happen all the time in larger organisms as well.
Are there any other arguments in terms of either against evolution from Neff or arguments for evolution from Dr. Wilson that are different from what we've discussed so far? Yeah. Something new, changing it up.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I would respond that.
Responding to the last argument. Somebody's got to have the last word on each of these arguments.
Okay.
Neff, we can give you the last word on the next argument, but I do want to change gears into a new argument.
Okay. Well, I would completely disagree with what my opponent just said. But
okay. Now, I would say that, but we do. I just want to be sure. Are you just going to go back to the same argument and respond to what he just said, or are you changing gears?
Yeah, sure.
I would provide that the
existence of the DNA molecule itself discredits evolution theory conclusively. The existence of it. Natural chemistry can never produce DNA. In a prebiotic Earth, scientists who are secular themselves have reported that there's no known mechanism for the development of the DNA molecule. They're scratching their heads. Such as Robert Shapiro, one of the world's foremost biologists and evolutionists, by the way, admits that you'll never get the sugar ribose backbone molecule of the DNA by natural chemistry. It's just never going to happen. Okay, and so on top of that, then we have the very existence of DNA, which is a material medium encoded with digital information more complex than Microsoft Windows, an operating system more complex than Windows, which is algorithmic and linguistic. Scientists have reported in the medical journals numerous times that DNA operates linguistically, algorithmically, semiotically. It has phonetics, semantics, punctuation, syntax, grammar, acrobatics, and semiotics. It also operates algorithmically. Algorithms, information, linguistics, semiotics are all products only of intelligence. So the evolutionist is completely in denial of 20th century science because of their 19th century myth, actually 3,500-year-old myth, because modern science has proven that DNA is information, linguistics, and algorithms, which can only be produced by an intelligence only. If that's true, evolution is not true.
Well, we'll give a chance to Dr. Wilson to respond.
Yeah, so this is kind of getting away from evolution and into abiogenesis, So evolution explains the diversity of life that we see. Abiogenesis tries to answer the question of how all those molecules that make life got there. So that's kind of getting outside of the discussion of evolution and more into abiogenesis is what I would say to that. Also, I'll add, just for the sake of argument, that DNA is incredible. It is operating in ways that are really complex. But all that complexity kind of emerges from a relatively simple set of rules, which is complementary base pairing. Four letters, ATCG, complementary base pair together. And from that rule and a few other chemical properties of the molecule, you get a very wide array of really complex mechanisms. And I don't think that necessitates intelligent design because, well, we can understand the properties that govern the mechanisms in DNA and its chemistry. I don't think you can't test whether or not an intelligent designer created DNA because it's not falsifiable. I guess we can go back to that point that I made in my opening statement. It's just not falsifiable because no matter what you observe, you can just say that the creator created it that way.
Okay, so here's the mistake you made. You pointed to the fact that the ACGT interdependencies from one strand to the other on the DNA molecule determine which base pair can attach or is not able to attach on the other side of the DNA molecule. That doesn't have anything to do with how it became specified. And a beautiful example of that is that modern science, which evolutionists despise, demonstrates that the information on one strand of the DNA read one direction can produce one set of instructions, while the other strand read even in the opposite direction produce a different set of instructions. So give us reason to believe that DNA, natural selection, there is no such thing as chemical natural selection that can produce a DNA molecule. It only exists in the fantasies of evolutionists. The incredible discovery of modern genetics is that DNA genetic information is strand hopping, reverse and forward reading, overlapping and compressed information, and it can even hop strands and read verse backwards. So it doesn't matter that if you have A on one side, you have to have a G on the other. It doesn't matter. That doesn't matter. It's not like natural chemistry could even produce that, couldn't even produce the backbone. It's not going to happen. According to Robert Shapiro, one of the world's foremost genetic biologists. And he's an evolutionist. He's just being honest. He's saying, look, I can't figure it out. I'm one of the world's experts. I can't figure it out. If you guys can, let me know. That's what he's published. You know, he's just being honest. He doesn't say, I believe creation. He just says, I can't figure it out. It doesn't seem plausible to me. But, hey, that's what it is. And nobody's arguing against Shapiro. Nobody has said Shapiro's wrong and this is why he's so blatantly wrong. Nobody says that. They just say, well, Shapiro's right. We got to figure it out, right?
Okay. I just want to focus on one thing you said, which is the directionality of DNA. So, yeah, we know that DNA is two strands that base pair together, and one strand is read one direction, the other strand is read the other direction. There's one directionality to each strand. Why is that weird? Why is that evidence against evolution?
Yes. Oh, that's a marvelous question. Because it demonstrates that the designer was so ingenious that two completely separate and critical sets of information were written at the same time when one side was encoded. It demonstrated that another set of instructions for other biological functions in the organism were written at the same time. that are completely unrelated to the other.
Or
and critical to the organism's existence. To believe that that could arise by natural chemistry is absurdity.
Why?
Because of the complexity of it. Because both are necessary, and because of the complexity of it. Evolutionists hate complexity.
Because both, what both is necessary?
What both? Both sequences of information may be necessary to the organism's existence, and yet they're only dependent upon each other because of the arrangement. What this demonstrates is intelligent design at such a level that is beyond human comprehension. It is outrageously ingenious.
So I guess this kind of goes back to the irreducible complexity argument, because DNA, while it is very complex, we see that there are self-replicating particles that are lifelike viruses that exist with a single-stranded RNA genome. And, you know, that's a much simpler pseudo-life form than a double-stranded DNA helix-carrying organism. So to think that it had to start with two strands in an organism is not, that's not necessary at all. There's a simpler system that probably, you know, came before the more complex one.
Well, there's a simpler system that exists in the imagination of the evolutionists.
Well, no, plenty of
the evolutionist exists. Scientists themselves have discredited the RNA world hypothesis. They've acknowledged that the idea is implausible. Robert Shapiro is one of them. That this idea is just implausible. It's an ad hoc assertion, but nobody has science that demonstrates it. Secondly, you're positing that that this information that produces one strand on one strand and the other could produce by natural selection. Do you realize that what you're expecting us to believe is that as evolution produced one strand of information, at the same time it accidentally produced other information that's going to be so critical to the organism's operation that without the first one, the other one is no good?
Well, and
that to me demonstrates the absurd anti-science thinking of evolutionists. They believe in the most magical sort of situation where you can believe that the most complex information known to man could arise because molecules bump into each other, and yet man is not able to write information that complex or specified with Microsoft Windows. In Washington, United States, the Microsoft Corporation, one of the largest corporations in the world, can't write software that is as complex and functional as what's in your DNA. But you want us to believe that what's in your DNA happened because molecules bump around.
No. Evolution doesn't say that. But so
that's exactly what it says.
No, that's not what it says.
That is.
It is not. But you are kind of skipping the fact that, you know, it doesn't have to start as double-stranded DNA with one strand that perfectly complements the other. If you have enough single-stranded nucleic acid molecules, such as RNA or DNA around, eventually they're going to be able to base pair with each other because it's only four letters. So eventually you're going to get mechanisms that allow these two single strands to base pair together. And then if that mechanism is favorable to the fitness of whatever organism is carrying those molecules, then that'll be selected for. And then over time, we get DNA stored in the nucleus.
Eventually. So how long is this? What is this time scale of yours where you believe that eventually one bit of information, one little tiny, bite of information in the DNA gets selected for so many times that it becomes critical. And then not only becomes critical, but it designs something. And then numerous events like this happen so that it designs something more and more and more, and then becomes the proboscis in a mosquito. I mean, do you not realize that the time scale the evolutionists have equates to multiple times the existence of the universe, according to secular cosmologists. You're talking about trillions.
Two questions in a row that you've asked, Neff. Let's give him a chance to answer those.
Trillions times trillions.
Neff, like, how,
no, that's not
how does that, if I say let's give him a chance to answer, that doesn't mean keep going. Go ahead, Dr. Wilson.
It does not necessitate trillions of years. But one thing you said, so how long would it take, right? So in my opening, the paper I showed where scientists were able to observe an enzyme adopt a new function to contribute to the fitness of the bacteria, that took 3,000 generations in a selective environment, and it required.
To do what? Can I ask you again?
I just want to hear what he said. It required two mutations. Come back to it. I promise.
No, I just want to hear what he said.
Do you want to give him a chance?
Can you? What was it that you say was observed? I'm sorry, I just didn't hear you.
Scientists observed
within generations. Could you repeat that, please?
So, within 3,000 generations, scientists observed an enzyme adopt two separate mutations. I believe it was a point mutation and an insertion that allowed this enzyme to adopt a completely new function that allowed the organism to survive in this selective environment that the scientists had created for it.
Okay, thank you. I wanted a clarification on that because I didn't hear what you said. Again, we're going back to Lenski. No evidence for evolution there. Survival in a petri dish doesn't demonstrate that the tusks of an elephant or the jaw of a marsupial can or the ear bones, the ossicles of a marsupial are going to evolve because of mutation. What I've been pressing you for a long time about in this debate is the evidence that random genetic mutations and natural selection can build the structural designs of living things. And what you've told me is that you believe it, and you believe it because bacteria can adapt in the environment in a petri dish and survive. And that's your belief on evolution. And that's not sufficient as evidence of evolution, as anyone with a clear mind.
Give them a chance to respond.
So, again, I'm trying to show you the fundamental mechanisms by which larger events happen, but I don't know why you're hung up on this idea that bacteria grown in the lab not being able to survive in a different environment is somehow disproving evolution. Because if you took bacteria from the environment and moved them into the lab and had them compete with the lab strain would win. So it's just a matter of, perspective. So I don't know why that's a problem for evolution. Right. It's like saying a fish is so adapted to the ocean, but if you move it to land, it's going to die. Like, I don't really understand where you're going with that.
Nephilim Free, are you there, Nephilim Free?
I just all I've heard is, speculations that, microbiological changes that occur in the bacteria demonstrates that evolution is true and it's produced the tusks of an elephant and, the eyeballs of a tiger. And to me, that's just anti-science. You're welcome to believe that. It sounds an awful lot like mythology because that's clearly what it is. It began with the Hindu Brahmin. It was passed on from them to the Babylonians, who passed it on to the Greeks. It was written about by Aristotle, Anaximander, Anaximenes, and Thales and Miletus. And that's where you got it. Then in the Renaissance, late Renaissance, during the Enlightenment era, the Freemasons cult got a hold of the idea, and they pushed it into the science, and that's where you believe it. But nobody has demonstrated science that demonstrates that mutations, natural selection, produce structural design changes that cause one type of organism to develop features that move it towards becoming a fundamentally different type of organism. We have absolutely zero scientific evidence for that. You can't talk about it. All you talk about is bacteria surviving in a petri dish, because you don't have any reason nor scientific evidence to demonstrate that one organism can develop into a fundamentally different type of organism because of mutation, natural selection over time. There's no such thing in science. No scientist has evidence of it. If evolution were true, you need to be able to tell me how DNA is a physical medium encoded with complex, specified, functional information which operates linguistically, algorithmically, semiotically, possessing phonetics, semantics, punctuation, syntax, grammar, and aprobetics. If you could tell us that, you could turn the world upside down, but you all can't right, provide any evidence of that. I would like to hear evidence for that.
Sorry. Sorry. Evidence that DNA is what you said it is just
well,
then?
The science journals report countless times by not creationists, but secular scientists have reported that DNA is complex, specified functional information, which operates
specifically,
semiotically, possessing phonetics, semantics, punctuation, syntax, grammar, and semiotics. Okay, and this is not the creationist papers. Evolutionists have published this. All right. So can you explain how those things can arise by natural chemistry?
It's chemistry. It is chemistry.
Can you explain it, though?
We have to give them a chance to actually elaborate.
So the nature of a nucleic acid with a nitrogenous base and a sugar backbone with four letters, ATCG, those simple chemical rules give rise to complex mechanisms. And, you know, we can go through an entire course on that, but I don't think that's really what the audience is looking for. I think it's weird that you keep calling evolution mythology when, so evolution is trying to answer the question of how did this diverse array of life get here? We can hypothesize that it got here from random mutation and natural selection, and that all life is related to each other and on some level. And we can go out and test that idea. We can look for evidence of it, and we find evidence of it all over the molecular world, all over the fossil record, all over every discipline in biology. But the other answer that you seem to be pushing is that it was an intelligent designer, which you can't test and you can't falsify. So I don't see one as I don't see evolution as mythology and the other as science. You know what I'm saying? Like,
well,
how do you test or falsify an intelligent designer?
We'll give you a brief response, Neff, and then we're going to go into Q&A.
Okay, it's absolutely testable and observable and repeatable that DNA is information, complex, specified information, which operates linguistically, algorithmically, semantics, punctuation, phonetics, syntax, grammar, linguistics, algorithms, and semiotics. That's a fact. It's been published in the science journals over and over and over and over again by evolutionists themselves. So the fact is, those things can only be produced by intelligence. It's impossible for natural chemistry to make them. Therefore, evolution is false. Intelligent design is a scientific fact. Like it or not.
We're going to jump into the Q&A and want to mention, folks, our guests are linked in the description. So both Dr. Wilson and Nephilim Free are linked below. Folks, if you want to hear more from them, they have their own channels. You can hear plenty more to your heart's content. And as I had mentioned, folks, that includes if you are listening via the Modern Day Debate podcast, as we also put our guest links in the description box for each podcast episode. And so we highly encourage you to check these guys out. We really do appreciate them. And I can tell you guys, a lot of positive feedback. People really enjoyed this. And so it's been a really fun time. We've got questions we're going to go through. So we're not done yet. We are going to start with, let's see, Steven Steen, nasty guy, says, Neff is my scientific hero of truth. Got a fan out there, Neff. And Andrew Rouse, thanks for your kind words, says, James, it's Rouse like house, remember. That's right. Says, and yes, over here, near midday in Australia, keep up the effing good work, my guy. Thank you for that, Andrew. And we're always excited when people from around the world tune in and say hello. So Barry, thanks for your super chat. Says, miss you, Neff. Hope all is well. When are we going to have a debate on this channel about the reasonableness of belief in God? James, let's do this. Well, that might work. Could be a juicy one. Then we have a message from Raw Nakedness, which has been deleted. She must have said something really bad. Dustin Ellerby, thanks for your question. Said, how can a mind exist with no data, yet can create matter out of nothing to produce complex life? I'm not even sure what that's for. How can a mind exist with no data? That's okay. Go ahead, Neff.
Oh, I just say no data. Well, the data is all in the hands of the creationist. It's been demonstrated for 90 years that mutations are destructive. And the evolutionist believes in their pseudoscience that mutations design upon each other, they build upon each other to create complex stuff. It's a myth that it requires deep time that nobody can observe. It's a fantasy. What's observed is that mutations cause weakness, deformity, and death. That's observable, testable, repeatable science.
Juicy. This one coming in from Raw Nakedness. Says, why did God make metal hydroxides tend to appear in lots of active sites in current molecular biology? This is a prediction of the Z-world hypothesis. Nephilim Free, I think this is for you.
Okay. The Z-world hypothesis is counterbalanced by the cube hypothesis, which is heavily weighted on the I hypothesis, which nobody knows the origin of, except many speculate that it may be caused by the G hypothesis. We're not really sure.
Do either of you know what a Z-world hypothesis is? Okay, good. Me neither. Next up, Dustin Ellerby says, has anyone witnessed a God create complex life, Nephilim Free?
No, but nobody's observed evolution either.
Next up,
we can't observe the past. We can make speculations best based on the preponderance of evidence.
This one from the legend Rives says, since race isn't proven by science, how does population genetics explain evolution via race? This seems contradictory.
So, well, I mean, what we socially determine as race has valid evolutionary explanations just based on where those human populations lived in the world. And I'm not sure I understand the question further than that.
Me neither. I'm glad I'm not the only one. But this one coming in from Raw Nakedness says, eubacterial flagellum evolved from a secretion system. There are dozens of basal bodies on several species where that's all they do is secrete protein.
He's uninformed because modern secular biologists have acknowledged and they've published that it seems to be the other way around. Instead of the flagellum evolving from the secretory, the type 3 secretory system. It looks like the secretory system evolved from the flagellum because of the molecular arrangement of it. So that kind of kills that idea.
This one from Jupiter Darman. Thanks so much. Says, no question at this time, just showing some love for one of my favorite YouTube channels of all time and enjoying Dr. Wilson's presentation. So thank you for that. And Raw Nakedness Strikes Again says, HIV-1 evolved a viroperon, which is a port in the membrane. By your own admission, anatomical features have evolved under our own eyes, Nephilim Free.
It didn't evolve one. It modified an existing one. That's not evolution. And it doesn't relate to the complexity of multicellular organisms or explain how we should believe that mutations in natural selection were able to create anatomical features in the Big Bangs. No scientist has ever put forth scientific evidence for that.
Juicy, this one coming in from, appreciate your question. We do have some for Dr. Wilson. Church of Entropy asked, Dr. Wilson, how does evolution via mutation predict punctuated equilibrium?
Yeah, so that's the interesting thing about that is one of the papers I showed demonstrated that random genetic material can adopt new functions. So if mutation is always happening in the background, you're getting a wide variety of mutations accumulated in your genome that don't yet serve a function because, as we know, most mutations are neutral. But in terms, in a situation of punctuated equilibrium where there's a lot of selection pressure, that diversity of mutations within a population can give rise to new traits that can give some organisms in that selective environment an advantage. And so that's how random mutation can contribute to punctuated equilibrium.
Do I get to respond?
We've got 1,000 questions for you, Neph, so no. The next up, the Crawdaddy029 says, Nephilim Free, it's not information, it's not programs. We make comparisons like we compare the eye to a camera. And B, in addition to that, we are not at the pinnacle of science.
Well, I'd say the neutral theory was refuted in the 1950s by Kumura and others. But if you want to believe that mutations created microphones in Beethoven from rock soup, you're welcome to.
Raw Nakedness strikes again, saying, that's not true, Nephilim Free. The relationship between natural selection and kinetic chemistry is being elucidated. So prebiotic natural selection is a thing.
No scientist who is a researcher in the origin of life has acknowledged that we have a mechanism for the formation of a cell. They have all acknowledged that it seems well beyond their grasp, and the answers are completely unknown. This person is either deluded or completely uninformed.
Nephilim Free, this is your own daughter, Raw Nakedness, you're talking about. How dare you? Oh, wait, no, the last one was the Crawdaddy, your own son. The Crawdaddy strikes again. He says, Neph, Spanish is derived from Latin. Do you think a Latin-speaking mother gave birth to a Spanish-speaking child? If not, welcome to evolution.
I think Spantonians, it came to the Earth 30 billion years ago and created Plutonicus. And Plutonicus has evolved into modern Spanitard, which evolved into Spanish.
Let's see. Frankly, I don't. Dr. Wilson, are you able to explain what they're trying to get at with this question? Because I don't understand the analogy.
Could you repeat it again?
They said, Neph, Spanish is derived from Latin. Do you think a Latin-speaking mother gave birth to a Spanish-speaking child? If not, welcome to the evolutionary camp.
Oh, I think this is just supposed to illustrate gradual change over time. Like Latin and Spanish are two pretty different languages, and that change didn't happen.
Well, I would say the evolution of language doesn't demonstrate the evolution of biology.
It's analogous.
Absurd analogy.
Next up, the Crawdaddy 029 can't stop, can't get enough, says... Oh, no, that was his last one. Next up, Shogun Lobsters as creationists, such as Nephilim Free, are often critical of evolution and demand great evidence that they're so quick to dismiss. Yet we're supposed to take God's magic on faith alone, Nephilim Free? Isn't this hypocritical?
No, of course not. Because it's not like creationists don't provide scientific evidence. It's not faith as they would define faith. It's scientific evidence. This is an absurd sort of cherry picking game to play. You know, to say that we don't ever get scientific evidence for creationists. We just have to believe what they say. Well, if you're just going to not believe anything without investigating, you know, you're welcome to your delusions and ignorance.
Nephilim Free. This one comes in from Farron Salas, who says, quote, intelligent, unquote, design. So, quote, unquote, designed. It gave us a laryngeal nerve that detours an extreme length in humans and giraffes. An intelligent creator? I think not, Nephilim Free. Hmm.
Nobody has demonstrated that the development of a laryngeal nerve is possible in any evolutionary process. As well, it's possible that the organism adapting its physiology in the length of its neck and the possible reduction of it could explain the change in its length of its nerve. But that doesn't demonstrate evolution. Evolution requires us to believe that the feature itself came into being by evolution. Nobody has any scientific evidence that that's even possible for any feature of any living thing. So pointing to a change in an anatomical feature, which could only have been produced by intelligent design, and then claiming that this is the reason to believe in evolution, is an example of severe delusion.
You got it. And Andrew Cumming, thanks for your question for Dr. Wilson, says, what do you think is the relative importance of heterochronic, parentheses, time change, and heterotopic, in parentheses, location change, regarding changes in evolution?
Time change and location change. I'm sorry, I honestly don't understand the question well enough to answer.
Well, that makes two of us.
My bad. I'm a molecular biologist, not a strict evolutionary biologist, so I don't know all of the terms you might ask me about. Sorry.
No problemo. NOXD, thanks for your question. Says, good job, guys. And remember, the banana is the atheist nightmare, and it fits perfectly in your hand, perfectly in your mouth. Explain that, Dr. Wilson. I think you probably know who they're referring to.
Oh, yeah, yeah. The story about the banana fitting perfectly in your hand, I think that was Ray Comfort. Little did he know that humans selected for the banana to kind of do just that.
Juicy. This one coming in from Brandon Ardeline says, if Romans 1:20 is true, then why are we still having these debates? Is an infinite God not capable of giving us infinite reasons to accept creationism, Nephilim Free?
Well, if God created evolution, we wouldn't exist, because that's impossible, since DNA is information which is complexly overlapping, nested information that operates linguistically with semiotics, linguistics, algorithms, and is functional and interdependent. That can't be produced by natural chemistry. Natural chemistry causes things to decay and bump around, but it doesn't build fantastically complex, functional, useful things and necessary things. That's what chemistry doesn't do. No chemist in the world has ever reported or known of chemistry that produces complex, functional, necessary things by natural chemistry. It only produces decay, according to the second law of thermodynamics.
You got it, Ann. Thank you very much for this question. Coming in from Fennec Wolfox, says Shapiro actually said that self-sustaining autocatalytic chemosynthetic systems associated with amino acids predated RNA, not that it's impossible.
He said that's his belief system, but what Shapiro's also said is that no chemical pathway towards any biological DNA or complex system in a cell has been observed or is known by chemists. So his belief system is what the questioner is asking. Shapiro says this is what he believes. But what Shapiro writes in his papers is also that he knows of no potential mechanism in chemistry, in biology, for the formation of these things. And this is and he admits that this is a severe problem for the evolution theory.
Gotcha. And thank you very much for this question. Coming in from Snake Was Right. Good to see you, old buddy. Old long-time debater on here says, NEF modification of existing structures is evolution. Modification with descent, modification. Things don't evolve from nothing. Can you admit this?
Well, if things didn't evolve from nothing, then everything would be a bacteria. This is how obviously and simply that questioner has failed. I don't need to address it anymore. I could speak for an hour about that. But the simple response is, then there could be no evolution. End of story.
Gotcha. And Dr. Wilson got a question for you. Thanks so much for this one. Coming in from End Time Teacher says, for Dr. Wilson, at what point did creatures evolve from fish into large whales and others evolved into insects without bone structures? How can creatures go from bone to having no bone?
Well, insects have an exoskeleton, and creatures like whales have an inside skeleton. and when did fish evolve to whales? Well, it was a journey from the ocean to land, and then land creatures went back into the ocean, and there are transitional fossils for those stages of evolution that have been found. That process took place over hundreds of millions of years.
Gotcha. And this one, thank you very much for your question from Shogun Lobster, says, Nephilim Free, just because you question evolution doesn't automatically make ID correct. We don't have evidence for your watchmaker outside of wild Bible interpretations. Where is your hard evidence for ID?
The very existence of the DNA molecule, which is complexly organized information, which is strand hopping, forward and reverse reading, highly compressed, overlapping and nested, information which operates linguistically, possessing semiotics, algorithms, linguistics, phonetics, semantics, punctuation, syntax, grammar, and apropetics.
You got it. Juicy. And this one, thanks so much for your question. Fox says, question for Nephilim Free, if there's time, hypothetically, what would be evidence that you would see as supporting evolution? What would you have to see to be convinced?
The question is like asking, what would I have to believe to believe that robotic space monkeys of a purple sort have invaded the Earth, and we're all just in a delusion that they don't even exist, but they're here every day on the streets? That's about how absurd I would have to believe, you know, what the absurdity I would have to believe evolution.
Gotcha. And looking for any last questions, want to say, folks, we really do appreciate our guests. They are linked in the description. So if you want to hear more from Dr. Wilson or from Nephilim Free, you can. And that includes if you're listening to the Modern Day Debate podcast version of this debate, as we put our guest links in there as well. And so Folks, one last thing. See this debate on the bottom right of your screen, folks? It is going to be epic. You don't want to miss it. The day has finally come. Tomorrow, Matt Dillahunty returns to Modern Day Debate, taking on Christian apologist and scholar Dr. Kenny Rhodes, and whether or not there is good evidence for God. You guys, I am stoked for it. It's going to be phenomenal. So you don't want to miss it, folks. Seriously, I think it's just going to be ginormous, and we are excited that this crowdfund-sponsored event, it's the live showing is free to the public. So in other words, like, even if you hadn't put into the crowdfund, this one is actually going to be completely live, and then it'll be, of course, on the channel afterwards as well. So I will be right back with some announcements of other upcoming debates, as we've got a lot of juicy ones coming up, but want to give a final thank you to Dr. Wilson and Nephilim Free. It has been a true pleasure to have you guys tonight.
Thanks a lot, James. It's awesome.
My pleasure. And actually, there are just two last really quick questions. A Bubblegum Gun just fired this in, said there simply even hasn't been enough time for the evolutionary model to even work, Dr. Wilson. And random mutations are literally entropy. You will not get humans like that. Give you a chance to respond. So they can make comments as well as questions. So
yeah. So, I mean, evolution happens on multiple timescales. We can see mechanisms of it happening today, right now, and we can see evidence of the long-term timescales that were necessary for larger changes in things like the fossil record. What was the second part of that question?
They had said that random mutations or entropy, you won't get humans like that.
Right. No, it's not just mutation. It's mutation and natural selection. And it's, I think this entropy point is alluding to the second law of thermodynamics. And that doesn't really apply here because second law of thermodynamics refers to a closed system. And the Earth is not a closed system. We receive energy from the sun. So we can take that energy in to build complex things rather than just sit and break down.
Is there any part of the Earth that doesn't decay because of the sun? Neph.
I'll give you a chance to answer that, Dr. Wilson, if you want. Otherwise, I've got one question for you, Neph.
Is there any part of the Earth that, sorry, doesn't decay or does decay? What did you ask?
Yeah, is there any part of the Earth that doesn't decay, especially because of the sun?
I mean, I think your question is missing the point
made. Right.
We must move to the next one. Yeah. This one from your daughter, Raw Nakedness, says, does Nephilim deny the existence of Viretes? It's spelled V-I-R-E-T-E-S.
I deny
then,
that.
Which they say, which are capable of lateral gene transfer.
I deny that lateral gene transfer is able to produce the information necessary to create the anatomical features that evolution requires.
Gotcha.
Anyone who believes that is believing in a myth. They're not believing science.
Juicy. And we do have a thumbs up, you could say message of gratefulness, as we do appreciate that. Thanks so much for your positivity. This one coming in from Heat Shield. Appreciate the positive vibes and the energy you bring here, my friend. Says a totally neutral thank you from me to both guests for this tonight. And they said, since I've never met Dr. Wilson before, a little extra handshake to welcome him to the party. So again, thank you, Dr. Wilson and Nephilim Free. We'll be right back, folks. But again, our guests are linked in the description. We really do appreciate them. And we'll be back in just a moment. So stick around.
Swimsuit? Check. Sunscreen? Check. Phone charger? Check. Don't forget to pack the 5-Hour Energy. It fits great in a pocket or carry-on, and the alert feeling will help you arrive ready for anything. Now get 20% off when you use code 5HETRAVEL at 5HourEnergy.com. Expires April 30th. One-time use only. Not valid with other discounts. Remember, visit 5HourEnergy.com and use code 5HETRAVEL to save 20%.